Market forces currently affecting the U.S. healthcare system have contributed to poor health outcomes, but the financialization of healthcare isn't new, and understanding today's corporatization requires seeing it from a historical perspective. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Nancy Toms, a professor of history at Stony Brook University. Dr. Toms has written a perspective article about the history of profit-driven medicine in the United States as part of the journal series on the corporatization of U.S. healthcare. Dr. Toms, in your perspective article, you trace current corporate influences in healthcare to shifts that started in the 1920s. So before the 1920s, how were prices set and how was healthcare paid for?
It was a direct system in that physicians submitted bills to patients and patients paid them. There were no third parties, with the exception of charitable institutions where people who were considered the worthy poor could get free medical care. But the foundation of medical practice was a physician as a solo practitioner with a patient client base that helped him pay his bills.
And you say in your article that starting in the 1920s, the medical profession adopted a new business model that medical profession leaders deemed better suited to the U.S. economy. What was different about that model?
There was a concerted effort starting after World War I to help physicians start thinking more like businessmen. And I use men advisedly because most of them were men, to be more mindful of investing in themselves, that as medicine became more dependent on new technologies, new procedures, new drugs, physicians had to invest in themselves, in their education and their continuing medical education, so they could provide those. But in order to do so, they had to become more systematic in billing their patients. So the classic image of the old country doctor who sent bills at best once a year, he would accept a bushel of potatoes in lieu of that bill, that American doctors had to say farewell to the old country doctor and become a doctor who could live in the same world with the new style American business. And much of that new style were, in fact, national corporations that were structured in terms of having external investors having to show a profit, having to adopt more business-like methods. For the American medical profession, they did not adopt the corporate structure and the external investment, but they did adopt the concept of becoming more business-like in terms of thinking about investment and return on investment, better billing, and just a more mindfulness of the physician's need to be an economic actor as well as a scientific and social actor.
So, what were the effects of that on care delivery?
There were some good aspects of this in that physicians became more aware of creating office spaces that were welcoming to patients. So part of this shift is also the beginning of the decline of home visits by the house call by family physicians. That instead of going to your patients' houses in your first in your horse and buggy and then later in your car, you would get your patients to come to you in your office. So there's a lot of attention and encouragement to American physicians starting in the 1920s, and it continues to this day to try to create a reception area that's welcoming to patients. So you could expect to come in and find places to sit while you waited for the doctor to call you in. There'd be magazines on the side table. When I tell this story, I in fact lived this transition in that my family physician, when I tell you that story, I flash on what it was like to walk into his office in Louisville, Kentucky in the 1950s and in the 1960s. There would be paintings on the wall. There was a friendly nurse to help get you ready for your visit to the doctor's. It's definitely not retail. It was very different from walking into a drugstore, for example, but there was definitely a sense of wanting to welcome the patient and prepare them for a successful visit. Once you had that successful visit, and my family doctor was amazing, he sent a bill that my father would pay. That was part of this mindset. You deliver the service and you're billed for it. And your obligation as a patient is to pay that bill.
And as you said, at that point, essentially no third parties. What then led to the introduction of insurance companies and federal insurance programs in U.S. healthcare?
So this model of direct billing, physician submits the bill, the patient pays it, worked reasonably well for what I'll call everyday kinds of medical problems. Where that understanding ran into some serious difficulties was if you as a patient needed hospital care, you had some urgent medical event that required you to be hospitalized, there would be a new set of bills from the hospital, as well as your private physician coming to see you in the hospital. And then there would also be the doctors in the hospital who are part of this new economic arrangement. And those bills were often unexpected and they were sizable, so much so that even a prudent, middle-class, reasonably well-paid would have difficulty meeting those hospital bills. The way the third party economically comes into this picture is creating a system of insurance. It's first for hospitalization, and then over time it expands to include non-hospital visits, a way to basically help people save for that medical rainy day. So you pay into this account, and in time, your employer also pays into it. So it's a system of pooling the risk of an event for any one person at any one period of time. And as we know, the more people you get into the pool, the easier it is to finance this kind of sharing of risk. So the bigger the pool of potential people paying in makes this work as an expense that, again, your average person can build into their budget. It's not all at once. It's a payment that they're making over time. Americans as a people have really liked insurance as a product dating back to the 18th century, fire insurance. Life insurance had become very popular even among working class people by the late 19th, early 20th century. I don't entirely understand the fiscal mechanisms here, but it was very difficult for insurance companies to figure out how to offer hospital insurance in a way that worked, that allowed the insurance company some profit for providing the service and allowed the parties involved to get what they wanted out of it. But they achieved that. This is Blue Cross Blue Shield. Again, this is a very familiar story to historians, that that's the original model, and then it expands with other kinds of employer-based insurance in the 1950s onward.
So how did the expansion of insurance coverage affect healthcare costs, including investments in new products and new procedures?
It set up a cycle that, in retrospect, it's like, of course, this was going to happen. Who determined the prices in these early insurance arrangements? It was the hospital. It was physicians. At this point, hospitals, they certainly had external community members sitting on their board of directors. But the rise of the modern hospital in the 20th century until we get to the 1960s and 70s is doctor dominated. So it's physicians running the hospital and making decisions about what to invest in. By setting up an insurance system to cover hospital costs, it created an incentive for physicians to move more care into the hospital because that would facilitate the funding and the patient's ability to cover that care. Basically, hospitals and doctors decided what to charge under these new systems. And not surprisingly, the prices started to go up. And this could be justified on the part of the hospital. We need a new X-ray machine. if we're going to compete with Hospital X across town, we need an even better X-ray machine. And you can imagine, you just fill in the blank for all the new technologies that come into play in the 20th century. And there you go. It just started a cycle of shifting care into hospitals and the prices rising. If you had insurance, this could still be difficult to cover. There were still out-of-pocket expenses. You had to meet a minimum, and it was not entirely a wash for an insured patient. But what about the people who did not have this insurance? And there were a lot of them, non-industrial workers, just many lower income people who are working very hard, but their employment does not come with hospital insurance. And then, of course, the obvious problem is that when you retire, you lose that insurance. So we have a crisis, an insurance crisis by the late 1950s, early 1960s, because this private employer-based system, there are too many people falling outside of it. But the price system is such that even if there's adjustment, as there was for an elderly person, that the costs are still too high for the people left out of that system to pay. And that's essentially how the federal government becomes a player to step in and to kind of provide the funding and the system to pick up those retired people, that's Medicare, and low-income people who are employed but have no insurance, that's Medicaid. When those programs are set up in the 1960s, in order to overcome the considerable resistance of the American Medical Association and other professional medical professional groups, the deal that was struck was that in Medicare and Medicaid, doctors could continue and hospitals could continue to set the prices. So that spiral of rising costs that I described, the private side, then goes into overdrive once the federal government is also pumping in this funding with no limits on cost. And that sets us up for the crisis of the 1970s that essentially we've been in ever since, which is trying to figure out a way to control for costs in this new insurance-funded system.
You write too that the shift to a corporate business model in the end led to physicians losing control over their economic fates. So, who controls their fates today?
A good question. I'm a historian and not an economist, but I can read the financial pages, the Wall Street Journal, as well as the Next Citizen. And what strikes me most is to look at what their parallel worlds, and they certainly speak to each other, but they're difficult to reconcile. One world is a world of financial players who are no longer just doctors. I would say this model that I described, the old model, succeeded so well that external investors saw opportunities in healthcare for venture capital, for just people looking with pots of money that they needed somewhere to invest them. What a good idea. Let's invest in medical technology. Let's invest in pharmaceutical research and development. So a kind of new set of stakeholders comes into play, but their expectations of what they're going to get back from that investment are very different from that original, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield. The healthcare group now has to show a profit to these external investors who are often far removed from the everyday delivery of healthcare. And the more influence they get, the less physician input matters, in the sense that, and let me be clear, there are physicians who are involved in this very high level financing. I'm thinking here of like the JP Morgan Healthcare Conference every year that brings together biotechnology investment groups with innovators in medical technology, pharmaceuticals, vaccine development, et cetera. That's a big stage now where decisions are made about what that next round of products are going to be that we as a nation have to figure out how to pay for and make accessible to others. But that can become very difficult when the stakeholder is so far removed from the actual practice of medicine. The most obvious metric I can offer to understand this is the percentage of physicians now employed by either a corporation or a corporate-like organization. The latest government statistics suggest 70% of physicians work for a corporate entity, and that means they have less autonomy to question decisions, risk constraints on their practice. How long do you have to meet with a patient? 15 minutes. What services can you offer? Well, this is basically what you have to choose from, et cetera. So I think, again, one metric of how this has affected physicians is the amount of time they end up on the phone with pharmacy benefit managers or health insurance companies having to argue for a treatment that they think their patient needs.
Finally, you write that given the negative effects of corporatization, U.S. healthcare needs a new business model. So based on these lessons from the past, what would that model look like?
I wish I could give you a better answer to that question. I'm hoping that other contributors to your perspective series will come up with those ideas. I, at the moment, am feeling quite pessimistic because what I see happening now is the one fail-safe measure in this system was the government assuming the public side of the public-private partnership and having some sense of obligation to care for all Americans. That assumption is under attack. So it's very hard for me to imagine what is going to happen next. The system we have is deeply flawed. It's fragile. You can find that assessment across the board from evidence-based evaluation of how the healthcare system works. But to remove the profit motive, that's simply not going to happen. So is there a way to rein it in, to set more realistic estimates of what a decent profit margin is? I would imagine so, but do I see any will to do that? Absolutely not. So I have no idea what's going to happen next.
Thank you, Dr. Toms.